This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Chelsea has spent $2.1 million since November giving direct cash assistance to nearly 2,700 low-income residents. Supporters of the program called Chelsea Eats have said that giving cash directly to those who need assistance is more respectful and also more efficient in providing for basic needs. Well, a new examination of how people use the money suggests they're right. 73% of expenditures went to locations where food's the primary product. Think grocery stores, wholesale stores, convenience stores, restaurants. And a significant percentage went to local businesses. Researchers at the Harvard Kennedy School's Rappaport Institute for Greater Boston conducted the study. Joining us to talk more about the program and this data is Chelsea City Manager Tom Ambrosino. Tom, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So, Tom, we talked with you in October just as you were getting ready to launch Chelsea Eats. You said then that while you knew this wasn't something the city could necessarily sustain with its own funds long term, you were hoping the results would help people rethink this idea of direct cash support programs, which have been quite controversial. Were these the kinds of results you were expecting and hoping for?
Both. We were hoping for them, and frankly, we were expecting that people would spend this money responsibly, and that's exactly what the data shows.
So tell us a little bit more about what the data told you.
So the majority of the money, more than a majority of it, was spent in places where likely people bought food, supermarkets, grocery stores, places like BJ's and Costco. A lot of the money was spent right here in the city of Chelsea, particularly at some of the largest supermarkets like Market Basket and Campari, Shop and Compare. So we felt very enthusiastic that the program worked. And there were certainly good substantive reasons for us switching to this model as opposed to the pantry model.
And remind us what some of those were, Tom.
Well, the city was running its own food pantries, its daily food pantries, from the start of the pandemic until close to the end of September. We were doing it because the food security needs were food insecurity was extraordinary here during that height of the pandemic, and we had to provide for it in some way. And so we were doing it initially by daily food pantries, but we were finding it was a very inefficient way to deliver this service. We were spending lots of money on non-food items like temporary employees, trucking costs, packaging costs. And so that wasn't all that helpful. In addition, it was an undignified way for people to get this need met. We had long lines, particularly in the heat of the summer. People would stand in line sometimes for more than an hour waiting for a heavy box of food. Lots of our residents don't have cars, so that meant they had to carry this heavy box home, sometimes for blocks, sometimes for longer. So we realized there was a way to do it more efficiently and with more dignity, and that was simply by giving people a card where they could go and buy whatever food they wanted and also meet other necessary needs they had if they were not food related. We felt it was just as important for them to pay a utility bill or to get some transportation or do whatever was needed for them to get their lives back in order, given how disrupted they had been by this pandemic.
So you talked about the dignity of doing it this way, but you guys had to hold a lottery. Not everyone who had before been standing in those hot lines waiting for heavy boxes of food were able to get one of these cards with $200 or $300 or $400 a month on them. What happened to those folks over these last few months?
So, you know, unfortunately, just that the demand outstripped our supply. We had a certain amount of money that we thought we could raise and provide through both government sources, and we just weren't able to accommodate the 3,600-plus families who applied for the program. So we ended up having a lottery. We selected just over 2,000 winners, and for the balance of those who didn't get a card, we continued to maintain support for some of the existing food pantries in the city. There are still ongoing daily food pantries in the city. The city of Chelsea supports those pantries in different ways. We simply are not running our own independent municipal food pantries any longer. We've replaced those with this Chelsea Eats debit card, but other pantries continue to operate with city support, and it's to those where we have to refer those unlucky ones who did not secure a Chelsea Eats debit card.
So, Tom, this is unfolding on the front lines of a debate that's going on about guaranteed basic income programs. When we talked with you in October, we also there was a representative of the Shaw Family Foundation. They provided extensive financial support alongside the government money to do this program. And they were pretty clear that this was a pilot for universal basic income or guaranteed basic income, whichever one you want to call it. How do you see these results as feeding into that debate, because the debate is around the use of direct cash payments to support people?
Well, first, let me just take a moment to thank the Shaw Family Foundation publicly. They've been enormously generous in their support of this program. It could not have happened without them. In terms of what it means for universal basic income programs, I think it is we're providing evidence that these things work. I mean, I think it's obvious. When you give people cash money, they are better off, especially people who live on the margins. When you give them additional cash, it makes their lives better. It improves not just their economic outlook, but it improves their mental health for their entire family. They're just not struggling as much as they would be in the absence of this money.
So what are you hearing when you talk to residents who have been able to participate in the program? What do they tell you about how they use the money, what it means to them, how it has changed their sense of self-agency, for example, if I can imagine something you might hear about?
You know, the stories I'm hearing are anecdotal. We're engaging with a handful of people. They come here, they lost a card, we give them another, and we engage them in how they're doing. But all of the people are extremely grateful that they're getting this unfettered money, and all of them are happy that they have this little extra income. Some of them may continue to use it for food. Others use it to pay a phone bill that they fell behind on, a cell phone bill, a utility bill. The necessities that all of us who are a little better off take for granted, these people struggle with. And this kind of debit card, which is allows them to spend anywhere Visa is accepted, just takes the edge off the financial distress they can be under each month.
So this is a pilot. You've extended it until June. Can it or will it continue beyond that in any form?
So, working with the Shaw Foundation, the city's hoping to extend it through Labor Day. I'm reasonably confident, but we're not ready to announce that yet. After that, no. This is an expensive program, but it's a program that government, state and federal government, should be supporting. It's a much better way, it seems to me, to get to solve this problem of financial need and food insecurity than current existing programs that have a lot of barriers to people and are very often restrictive in the way people can spend money.
So you're not formally announcing Labor Day yet, but you just said that that's sort of the target to extend it through. But then what happens? So people have had $200, $300, $400, sort of depending on family size, et cetera, extra dollars, and that's going to go away. Any worry that that loss does real harm to those families?
Well, yes, it's a worry, but it's our hope that by then many of these families will have had a chance to get their jobs and hours back. Most of the people who signed up for this program were people who were in distress because they had lost jobs entirely or had hours cut back. The surveying we've done that Harvard University has done has clearly established that the thing these people want most is to get their jobs and hours back. They're not looking for a handout. They're looking to get back to work. The data and the surveys prove that. And our hope is that by Labor Day, with the economy continuing to improve, there won't be as much need for this extra money as there was during the height of the pandemic.
And Tom, just briefly, how is Chelsea faring? We've been following the journey of your community throughout this pandemic.
I would say in terms of health-wise, Chelsea is doing much better. Our numbers are significantly lower now than they were at the height of the pandemic last spring. And even during the second surge over the winter, our numbers are dropping. Lots of people are getting vaccinated. So we're doing, health-wise, we're doing quite well. You know, the economic impacts will linger here for quite a while, but we're optimistic that things are getting better and that there's a light at the end of the tunnel.
That is Chelsea City Manager Tom Ambrosino. Tom, as always, thanks for the time. It's good to talk to you.
Okay, thank you.
From 2000 to 2019, about 19,800 people died of an opioid-related overdose here in the Commonwealth. That data is from the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. And those are just the Massachusetts numbers. Yet accountability for the opioid crisis and the lives lost remains elusive. Many state attorneys general, including Massachusetts AG Maura Healey, have taken aim at Purdue Pharma, the company behind the powerful prescription opioid OxyContin. Healey expanded that effort just last week, filing a lawsuit against a marketing firm connected to Purdue Pharma for the role that it played in creating the opioid crisis. But there's also the Sackler family, founders and owners of multi-billion dollar Purdue Pharma, and we've covered them extensively on WBUR and Radio Boston, both the charges against them and their responses. You can find that coverage on our website, radioboston.org. The Sacklers are the focus of a new book from Dorchester native Patrick Radden Keefe. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of Empire of Pain, The Secret History of the Sackler Dynasty. We spoke with Keefe recently and began with the history of their signature drug, OxyContin, and its relationship to an even earlier drug, MS-Contin, essentially a morphine pill, that Purdue and the Sacklers gamed into the U.S. market without FDA approval.
The idea was that they wanted to develop a morphine pill so that you could administer morphine to people suffering from pain, but you wouldn't have to do it on an IV drip or with a needle. And they did. It had this very novel coating around the morphine. And the idea was that it would slowly regulate the flow of the drug into your bloodstream. This is the Contin in MS. Contin is short for continuous. And they sold it in the UK. And then they wanted to sell it in the U.S. And at that point, what you would normally do is go to the Food and Drug Administration and go through this pretty cumbersome bureaucratic process where you file a new drug application. But what Purdue Pharma elected to do was they said, well, you know, morphine's not a new drug. It's an old drug. It's been around for a long time. So we've just decided this isn't going to apply to us. We're just going to go ahead and start selling the drug without asking anyone's permission. And they went ahead and did it.
Is that phrase, we're just going to go ahead, is that a fair other subtitle for your book?
It might be. I mean, this was part of the reason that I was so intrigued by that episode, and indeed by other episodes that come earlier in the book. You know, I chose to tell a story that is a family saga, really covering about a century.
Yeah, generations.
Not just an OxyContin story. And part of the reason that I was interested in that is that there are all of these things that happen earlier that presage what happens later. And I think that moment with MS-Contin is fairly typical. They were going to see what they could get away with in terms of the regulatory environment. And they were going to come pretty close to the line in terms of, you know, potentially reckless behavior as a company.
All right. So OxyContin was different than MS-Contin, but the same tactics essentially went into marketing it and distributing it. It's almost like, and I am sorry for the pun, but I could not think of another way to describe this. It's almost like it was MS-Contin on steroids.
That's a good way of putting it. You know, it's funny. There are these amazing emails that I discovered where they're talking about how MS-Contin had been very successful for the company, but the patent was soon going to run out. And they were going to face generic competition on the product. And so they thought, we have to find something new that we can patent. And they were talking about other drugs that they could use with this Contin system. And they arrived on oxycodone. And oxycodone is another opioid. So both of these drugs, morphine and oxycodone, are derived from the opium poppy. And it's very strong. It's roughly twice as strong as morphine. But what they realized is that American doctors weren't as familiar with oxycodone. You would encounter it in drugs like Percodan and Percocet, which are kind of weaker painkillers where it's mixed with aspirin or acetaminophen. And they did these focus groups and they discovered that doctors thought that oxycodone was actually weaker than morphine. Now, the truth is it's stronger. It's much stronger. But they realized that doctors had this misapprehension. And there are these incredible emails in which very senior officials in the company say, let's not do anything to make them realize that they have that wrong. Let's let them continue to believe erroneously that this is a weaker drug and not a stronger one.
There was some other let's not do anything, too. One of the things that struck me was when you laid out in the book that Purdue didn't really research the addictive properties of OxyContin before marketing it. And I, how unusual is it for a company to not look into what a common sense would say is a serious potential side effect of the drug they are about to market? This is an opioid.
Yeah, I mean, to me, this is one of the big key questions in this whole story, right? Is that humans have known for thousands of years that the opium poppy and various products derived from it, you know, has incredible therapeutic benefits in the sense that it can relieve pain, but also has this downside, which is that it can be very habit forming. It can cause physiological dependence and indeed addiction. And it's not just that Purdue didn't conduct tests on how addictive the drug might be prior to releasing it. It's that they devised a marketing push which actually said that it wasn't addictive, that they just kind of blithely assumed that it wasn't without having actually done any real scientific work to back that up. This was driven, I think, because they were looking to position the drug a little differently than they had with MS-Contin. So MS-Contin was really primarily for cancer pain. And there was a very deliberate conversation with OxyContin where they said, we want to go after a bigger market here. There's only so many people suffering from cancer pain. What about people who have back pain, sports injuries, injuries they got on the job, arthritis? That's the market we want. And so that was the push, as they said, doctors should be prescribing this. They shouldn't just use it for cancer. They should use it for all kinds of conditions. And don't worry, it's not addictive.
So I want to take a moment here to say that a key part of your story is the Sackler family, and they had a history of quote unquote innovation in marketing pharmaceuticals. Arthur Sackler wrote the book on how you modern day pharmaceutical marketing, and the family was deeply engaged at every step in this. I'm going to ask you to read a little bit of a passage that speaks to the culture of the Sacklers in Purdue. This is a section where Richard Sackler is giving a speech to Purdue sales reps right after the launch of OxyContin. He almost missed the speech because of a major blizzard here on the East Coast, which he saw as a, quote, omen of change, end quote. Maybe you can pick it up from there.
A generation earlier, when Arthur Sackler helped Pfizer turn Librium into a blockbuster, the company had made it happen by recruiting an army of aggressive salespeople. Now, Purdue would do the same for OxyContin, and Richard proclaimed, the snowstorm back in Connecticut would be remembered as a mystical portent of their success. The launch of OxyContin tablets will be followed by a blizzard of prescriptions that will bury the competition, he predicted. The prescription blizzard will be so deep, dense, and white that you will never see their white flag.
And this blizzard was an apt metaphor, it turns out. And in fact, you lay out that Purdue actually tracked and targeted doctors who were prescribing a lot of OxyContin, pushed them to prescribe more, set that as a strategy managed by the family. Talk a little more about that.
Yeah, I mean, there was this big push. I think there was just huge ambition for this drug. And there was a, you know, I should say, I think there was greed, but I also think there was idealism. There was a sense that throughout human history, it had been impossible to disentangle the risky aspects of opioids, you know, from the therapeutic benefits. And they felt like we've cracked it. We've hacked it. We figured out a way to get opioids to people who are suffering from pain in such a way that they won't have to worry about addiction. Now, all of this turns out to have been conjecture and wrong. But what they did was they had this army of salespeople who went out and they met with thousands and thousands of doctors across the country. I've interviewed these former sales reps. They were very heavily incentivized to get doctors prescribing as much as they could. They all said they had this line that they repeated like a mantra where they would say, it's not addictive. It's addictive less than 1% of the time, less than 1% of the time. That's what they said again and again. The tagline, the kind of marketing phrase for OxyContin was, it's the one to start with and the one to stay with. So the idea was, this is not some nuclear solution that you graduate to when other courses of therapy have failed. This is what you, the first thing you do if somebody comes to you in pain is you prescribe them OxyContin.
So clarifying, the 1% was not an accurate claim.
It wasn't. It was a totally bogus claim. I think the company and the family was soon confronted with evidence of that, because it really didn't take long for the problems with the drug to make themselves known. But to me, that's where it becomes a really interesting story, is how they get kind of stuck in when it turns out that their initial hypothesis about the drug and what it can do turns out to be wrong. It's the sort of collective denial and delusion that they have in insisting that there's not a problem when there clearly is one.
So the Sackler family is where this story comes home to Massachusetts in a number of ways. Tufts became the first major university to remove the Sackler name from buildings and programs in 2019. That seems to have set off a chain reaction, a sort of next level abnegation of the Sacklers. Why do you think Tufts was the first to actually do it? And talk about the impact that had on a family who wanted its name public in philanthropy and hidden in business.
A couple of things happened. You know, there's this paradox that kind of runs through this story. And it's not just recent. I mean, this happened, I was able to trace it right back to the 1950s, where the family was very determined to put their name, the Sackler name, on all of their charitable gifts and gifts to museums, gifts to universities. You have Sackler Halls and Sackler Wings and Sackler Lecture Series, but never on the family business. And this was true in the 1960s when Arthur Sackler makes the first great fortune by marketing Valium, another addictive drug, but also true in the 1990s. And even when I started writing about Purdue Pharma initially in 2017, you could go to the website of Purdue Pharma, this company that the family owns that has generated all these billions, and search for the Sackler name, and you wouldn't find it anywhere. There was no acknowledgement on the company's website that it was owned by the Sackler family. So it's this weird thing where they put their names on all the philanthropy, but then keep their name off of the family business. And the real turning point, you know, I wrote a piece about the Sacklers in 2017 in the New Yorker. And at the time, I didn't think it would be possible to write a book because they were so secretive. And the big turning point for me happened in early 2019 when Maura Healey did something that nobody else had done up to that point, where pretty much every state in the union was suing Purdue Pharma over its role in the opioid crisis. But the state of Massachusetts sued individual members of the Sackler family for their role in helping direct what was happening at the company, and named a bunch of the family members who had sat on the board of the company. And that, I think, was a big turning point, because it laid out in black and white in this big legal complaint all the evidence that this was not some remote family that was checked out and just collecting the checks. They were calling the shots. In terms of Tufts, it was the students. It was the students. It was medical students at Tufts who said, I don't want to go and learn to be a doctor in a building that is named after this family. And the Tufts administration was, you know, they really listened to the students and eventually decided to take this quite radical step, which was to literally chisel the name off the walls.
So Attorney General Maura Healey here in Massachusetts names 8 Sacklers. You lay out that by the time she takes that step, they have extracted significant, if not most, money out of the company into personal accounts, sheltered accounts, etc. And you argue in anticipation of something like what A.G. Healey did.
Yeah, I mean, it's this crazy aspect of the story. And I should say it wasn't just significant, it was most. So in 2007, Purdue Pharma pled guilty to federal criminal charges of misbranding OxyContin. And they ended up actually pleading guilty again to a new set of federal criminal charges just this last year in 2020. And in the interim, you have all these states like Massachusetts bringing their own lawsuits against the company. What the public didn't know until fairly recently is that in the run-up to this period, the Sacklers are quietly pulling money out of the company. $300 million here, $400 million there. They end up taking more than $10 billion out of the company. And then when you have this huge kind of tsunami of lawsuits, they say, oh, too bad. Company doesn't have any money left. Purdue's going to declare bankruptcy. And basically said, we can't fight these lawsuits. We can't settle these lawsuits. We just don't have enough money. There's not enough money left. And the Sacklers are sitting on the sidelines, having pulled more than $10 billion out of the company. And they seem, at least for the moment, to be protected.
Ultimately, Attorney General Healy and other attorneys general, like New York's Letitia James, rejected a $10 billion settlement that was offered by Purdue and favored by some Republican attorneys general. It didn't reflect Sackler money, really. It didn't inflict financial harm on the Sacklers. The argument was that it wasn't enough, didn't really represent accountability. Later, the company reached a lighter settlement with the Department of Justice. Maury Healy has called that chump change. It doesn't name names or bring criminal charges against anybody. You paint that decision as a reader, it felt to me, in an attractive light, the decision not to compromise or take that settlement. In retrospect, is there an argument to be made that Maura Healy should have engaged more with the initial settlement offer to get some money that appeared to be on the table for things like addiction programs, local governments fighting the crisis on the ground, et cetera?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways of looking at it. I mean, I should say, and it all gets extremely complicated, but to break it down a little bit, initially the proposal by Purdue and the Sacklers, they alleged that this was a $10 to $12 billion proposal that they were making. I think when you actually look at the math, you know, and when you start breaking down those big multi-billion dollar numbers, a lot of that was pretty conjectural and sort of based on future profits from sales of things. I mean, it was, you know, in terms of the actual cash on the barrel, it was a much smaller number that they were offering. Specifically, the Sacklers were offering $3 billion of their own money. And Maura Healy at the time and some of the other, as you say, the more kind of forward-leaning state attorneys general said, that's not enough. You know, they would be walking away with the huge bulk of a fortune, which they pulled out of this company during a period of time at which we now know it was committing federal crimes. As to whether or not that was a savvy decision by Maura Healy to reject the initial offer, the Sacklers have subsequently upped their offer to $4.25 billion of their own money. So it, just in terms of the kind of pure negotiation, I think it was probably pretty smart not to take the initial offer.
You know, I sort of reached the final pages, about 450 pages into the book, and there's this journey we've been on. I know the public reporting, right, obviously, but I think I thought there was going to be a level of comeuppance that it feels like, it sounds like, it reads like just didn't happen. Is that right?
I think it is right. Look, on some level, this is a book about impunity. It's about the way the super elite in this country, the billionaire class, tend to be insulated at every level of the system from any real accountability for their actions, no matter how hazardous and disastrous those actions might be. I think the way this is going to end is that the Sacklers will end up giving up several billion dollars of their own money. They will walk away with vastly more. I don't know that there's going to be, you know, I don't think they'll face criminal charges. I don't know that there's going to be comeuppance of the sort that if you were a, you know, a retail heroin dealer selling heroin on the street, you might be faced with. I think they'll be insulated from that. You know, there's an anecdote that I relate in the book about Isaac Sackler, the original patriarch, the father of the original three Sackler brothers. And during the Great Depression, he loses everything and he gathers his sons. He tells them, listen, I have nothing to give you. I have no money. You're going to have to pay for your own educations. But I've given you the most important thing that a parent can give their children, which is a good name. This is at the height of the Depression. He says, you know, if you lose a fortune, you can always earn another one. But if you lose your good name, you can never get it back. And to me, that is this very powerful moment because it explains both the frenzy with which the Sacklers have put their names on things. But I think it also does articulate a kind of comeuppance. It's not justice. It's not real accountability. But I do think that this is a family that has been engaged in the kind of brand management of the family name for 7 decades. And I do think that at this point, the public has woken up to what happened with OxyContin and to the family's role in this. And so I think they've lost the good name. And that is something that I think they will never get back.
Patrick Radden Keefe is a staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of the new book, Empire of Pain, The Secret History of the Sackler Dynasty. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Recently, we brought you the story of former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson and his reunification with his birth mother, Rachel Twyman. Tito was adopted at birth. During that conversation, Tito talked about his adoptive mother, Rosa Jackson, who encouraged him to search for his birth mother and find out more about her. Well, we wanted to hear Rosa's part of the story, too. So in honor of Mother's Day, we invited Tito and Rosa to speak with us together about their relationship and Tito's newfound relationship with his birth mother. When we spoke, Rosa told us how she and her late husband, Herb Jackson, brought Tito into their family. The Jacksons already had biological children but wanted to adopt because Herb had been raised in the foster care system, and as Rosa says, they both loved kids. Rosa told us that her only son lobbied for the family to get a baby boy because they were already full of women in the house. She and Herb filed the paperwork with the adoption agency and hoped for a boy who looked like her husband. Then the agency called her.
And they said, Mrs. Jackson, we need you and Herb to come down. We have a little baby here, a little boy. I called Herb. Herb said, okay, what time? So he comes by, he picks me up. We go downtown Boston to Joy Street. We went in. The nurse brings the baby in. Herb looks at me, I look at him. We were just like, it was like love at first sight. The two, it was just so amazing the way the two of us, our eyes connected. And we looked at it, and we both said at the same time, that's him. That day, Tito H. Jackson became our son. I went to the doctor's office, so I said to the doctor, now, they call him Billy, but Herb and I were up all last night looking at names, and I and Herb decided that we would choose T-I-T-O. Now, at the time, I was not thinking about the Jackson 5. That never crossed my mind. All I was thinking, I had this little baby, and I wanted to name him Tito. And I said to her prior to that, it's short, it's sweet, and be easy for him to learn how to spell.
Tito, how do you feel about your name?
The Tito Jackson thing, it's awesome, fantastic, and amazing. It has been a blessing in my life. It makes people comfortable because everyone cracks a joke. Oh, are you related to Michael or whatever? The name does stand out. When you're campaigning, it actually makes for a very symmetrical way of writing vote and Tito right under that. So that works out. I think my mom and dad were geniuses when it came, and they were political strategists when they came to this. No, but it's been a wonderful thing. And hopefully someday I'll meet Michael Jackson's brother, Tito.
So Rosa, yes. Tito has told us that you have been supportive through this process and that you encouraged him years ago to find his birth mother. When did you decide you thought that would be important for him?
Okay. At the time that my adoption Tito, it was told to me from the agency that at the age of 18, that Tito was allowed to, if he wanted to, look for his birth mom. So I decided along with her that when he was in high school. This is way before he was 18. And he has always been a very mature young man. So we decided that we would tell him this. And as a matter of fact, let me put it this way, tell them, because I had had two others that I adopted. So both Herb and I sat down and told them that they were adopted. And the reason we wanted to tell, because we didn't want anyone else to tell, because I want them to know that they were adopted, but they had a birth mom out there that we also wanted them to look for if they wish at the age of 18. And so it was around that time, I think Tito maybe was about 16 or 17, and I told him, all, the three of them, you all are to, if you wish, to go and look for your mother. And I said, whenever you're ready, I said, Dad and I will help you, you know, do whatever we can. But it has to be your idea that you want to do that. So that's when we told them, you know, all three of them together, that they were adopted, that they could also have permission to look for their parents.
Tito, you found out that you were born of a sexual assault in your college years, years before you finally connected with Rachel, correct?
Yes. This is Mom. What was the adoption agency? What was it Children's Services of Boston, Roxbury? Which one was it, Mom? It was Boston Children's Services. That's what it was.
Yeah.
It was Boston Children's Services.
I can't remember his name.
Yep. But they ended up sending me a narrative. And thankfully, they actually called me because they did notice the trauma involved. And it said, I think erroneously at the, at the time I thought it was the truth. They said that my biological mom was 13 years old and she had been assaulted by two men.
And Rosa, when Tito learned that about himself as a mom, did that change at all how you felt, Rosa, about Tito pursuing the rest of the story and finding Rachel eventually?
No, it did not. Because this is the way I feel. There was a mother out there somewhere that a possibility, I didn't know. I'm saying, I'm just thinking, because this is the way I would have felt. Had I had a child out there and had to give it up for adoption, I would think about that child, and especially on its birthday in April, you know, April 11th. I had said to my children, along the way, I feel that every child should know their parent, their biological parent. So I kept encouraging him and, you know, to do so. So I was happy that everything worked out the way it did, because I also feel that that mother feels that she's found what she lost.
Tito, when did you tell Rosa that you and Rachel, your birth mother, had talked? And were you excited to tell her? Were you nervous to tell her? Take us through that moment. Were you on the phone? Were you in person?
Yeah, I was on the phone. I got the call from the Home for Little Wanderers, who has since taken over the organization that I was adopted through. I was in my office alone, and they called and said, "Hey, we found your mom. Her name is Rachel. Here goes her phone number, and good luck." And Tiziana, I thought Oprah or like Dr. Phil was gonna walk in, and I was like, okay, where they at? They're not. And so, know myself. I can sometimes get paralysis by analysis. So I called Rachel directly. I had about a 20-30 minute call with her, and she shared with me the information about the book and the like, and some things about her life. And as soon as I hung up, my mom, who lives in Florida now, I picked up and called her and told her that I had found Rachel.
Tell us about that call, Rosa.
I was excited. I said, good. I'm so happy. What does she look like? That was my first question, So he told me, he said, Mom, she's short like you. I said, okay. I said, that's a good thing. But I was very happy. Because as I say, my belief is every child should know their parents. Now, I feel that now this is left up to him and his biological mom to connect. You know, I'm an angel now, God and him, and watching over the two of them, you know, to pray and hope that everything goes well. So I'm very happy for him. Because I feel that that was a missing piece of the puzzle in his life.
Tito, how do you react when you hear Rosa refer to herself as an angel now?
Well, she didn't have to wait that long to be an angel. When I think about how difficult Rachel had it, I also think about how blessed that I was to have parents who adopted me, who gave me the support, the education, the structure. On occasion, I got a spanking every now and then, Tiziana. And so we actually knew that we were quote unquote real family. We got disciplined just like everybody else. But my mom and dad have been angels from the beginning of their family, because in addition to adopting, they had over 50 foster kids in our house. And my mom is kind of a communal mom, and my dad was a communal dad, in that people would come and seek them out, and still do to this day, for advice and the like. And then my mom had a daycare at the house for 25 years. So is responsible for hundreds of young people being reared, taught, potty trained, and also, for them learning their numbers, their letters, and their gross and fine motor skills. So she didn't have to wait to this time to be an angel and my guardian angel. That started for me with the first meeting that I had with Rosa and Herb Jackson. And Tiziana, Rosa, this is probably the first time I get to call my mom Rosa in public, so I want to thank you for this opportunity. And she's in Florida, so yeah, I'm calling her by her first name.
Rosa, you talked about the decisions that you and Herb made about adopting Tito. You said Herb wanted a baby that looked like him. I want to play a little bit of sound for you of Tito talking about Herb during our conversation with him and Rachel a couple of weeks ago. Here it is.
My dad, he rarely called me Tito. He always called me my son. I was a younger man, I wanted to go and not be like my dad and do all this. And I'm literally doing everything that my dad was doing.
That's right. He sure is.
Rosa, has there been a moment, and maybe after Herb passed especially, where you looked at Tito and thought, that's Herb?
Well, you know what? It's been moments before Herb passed that I said, if he's not like her, oh my goodness, he's thinking like her, he's looking like her. I had one girlfriend come to me. She says to me, Rosa, she said, are you sure her's not the father of that baby? I said, well, I don't know. I said, but anyway, he looks like her. He acts like her. He does just what his father does. And he even talks like him.
How do you feel hearing that, Tito?
It makes me laugh just because, you know, the concept of nature versus nurture. I am definitely my father's son. My father passed away in 2002, but he fought literally to his death to make sure that women, people of color, and Boston residents got on construction sites. Literally the last conversation I had with him was about that. The work of the people and trying to help and better the community is a continuation mm-hmm. of my father's legacy. Even down, Tiziana, to the block party that I throw. My father used to do something called a block-a-rama, which is mm-hmm. just a block party. And yeah. he did it on my street. And I saw my parents, there are several apartment buildings around us, and my parents would open up their backyard and feed people. Literally, in you know, all of the folks in the neighborhood. So my turkey fry, which I do with 1,200 of our closest friends in our neighborhood, is really rooted in my parents opening up their home, opening up their backyard, their hearts, as well as their wallets to the community to make sure that we are connected, that we know each other, that we care about each other, and that we look out for each other. You know, I'd spent a lot of my life trying to be successful in business as well as in the civic sector and trying to help uplift folks. But now really thinking of that movement from success and focus on success to really the significant things in life and completing this whole and then continuing to build a relationship. And I really look forward to the time in which both of my moms can be in the same place and meet.
Tito and Rosa Jackson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for interviewing us.
Thank you. And happy Mother's Day, Mom.
Thank you, honey. I love you.
I love you too.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Walter Wuthman, with help from Stephen Gelman and Hafsa Qureshi. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.